This is episode 07. Actually, it's 007, 007 of The Bad Apples. Today I'm going to talk to you about the new iPods, because it's already been talked about so much. I've got a load of listener email that just never really fit in any other time, so I decided to just do the listener email this episode. Some really great questions, really fun ones. So we're going to do that, and I'll do a terminal line command of the week, and whatever else we can fit into this show. So stick around. So everyone by now must know, especially if you're a podcast listener like I am, or an Apple fan like I am, about the iPods, the new, brand new iPod line that Apple released. Very cool stuff. A lot of people seem to be sort of upset over the whole idea. The Nano's got a new look that was a bit jarring, probably. The Classic got a new look. The whole thing just has a different interface. There's a split screen now. I don't know if you haven't seen it yet. If you see it on the front page of the Apple website, or if you go into an Apple store, you'll see it right there. On the left-hand side of the screen is the list that we are accustomed to, and then on the right side is a kind of smoothly moving album cover or representation of whatever you're looking at on the left side in your list. So that's kind of new and flashy, and as I understand it, it is something having to do with the internal processor. So if you do an update to your current video iPod, as I understand, it will not, at least so far, I have sunk mine and updated mine, and it has not taken on a brand new user interface, so I'm assuming this is not just a software update to get this new user interface. I think it's I think it has to do with the particular processor that they're using in the iPhone and now the iPod Touch and the iPod Classic, things like that. The biggest exciting news, I think, really, I mean, even more than the iPod Touch, which of course is the big deal, I guess, to a lot of people. Not such a big deal to me because I have an iPhone already, so I'm not really that interested in an iPod Touch. But the big deal was the iPod Nano. It looks great. If you've seen it in real life, in the store, it looks a lot better than it sort of looks online and in the pictures and things like that. It's really, really thin. And it plays video, and that's a huge deal. If you think about the marketplace, and if you think about kind of the world moving toward digital content for entertainment that's delivered to you, to your computer, and then to your handheld device, having something at a $200 price point, or I think even a $150 price point, I'm not sure, I don't remember all the prices for the Nanos, but something in that range that will actually even play video on a good-sized screen, that's a big deal. It was kind of funny because some of the competing media players out there prior to the Nano had the capability of playing video, and they were flash-based devices. And so they were competing very directly with the Nano, saying, hey, why, just because you've got a Nano, can you not watch video? Well, you know, and that's true, and that's cool that they were doing it then. But if you look at the Nano screen and you look at the competitors, the Nano, I mean, they totally did the right thing by enlarging that screen. I mean, I remember, you know, 3 years ago, people were scoffing at the very idea of watching. I mean, people still scoff at the idea of watching video on a small screen like that. But now it seems fairly sizable. You know, the iPod video, I mean, people are really getting used to watching video on that screen. And that's the size of the screen on the Nano now. So it's totally a nice screen. They've got great resolution. Everything looks great on the screen. And it's a very affordable price. $150 for, I think, a 2 gig or a 4 gig, I forget. And you've got a 320 by 240 screen that looks fantastic. So very cool news, and I think it's a big step in the right direction of getting videos away from DVDs and just getting them right over the internet, right into your hand, right onto your computer or on your little iPod. And that's very cool because that's the kind of progress that I think art and the art world needs, to get away from the whole Hollywood monopoly. You know, I mean, you can't get your movie played in a theater if you're just an everyday artist, but you can definitely get it played on people's iPods if you promote your work. The venue is right there. It's the internet. Everyone's got access to it pretty much. So it's a very exciting move, I think, toward personal video. That's really cool. The iPod Touch came out, and it's funny because it seems like everyone was talking about a touchscreen iPod. It seemed to be like the big deal. Everyone wanted it before the September 5th big media event happened. And now that it's happened, no one seems to be talking about it that much. It's all about, you know, the new Nano and the iPhone price drop. And yeah, I mean, in a way, the iPod Touch, it does kind of seem underwhelming because chances are, if you wanted a touchscreen that bad, you probably got an iPhone, so you probably have the touchscreen media entertainment center already. But I'm sure that as Christmas rolls around, sales are going to start happening really, really seriously. But I think in terms of, again, the marketplace and kind of the move toward personal and portable entertainment, I think it's a big deal because it's a bigger screen, it's a cool little device, it of course does have the ability to just go online and grab stuff right offline. You can watch YouTube on it just like on the iPhone. You know, it's like a small, I mean, obviously it's an iPhone without the phone. It's cheaper. And it's really cool. It's actually a really cool device, or at least it looks like it. And I think it's a really, it's just really solid movement in the direction of personal entertainment. And it's really cool that Apple is behind all of this so firmly and solidly, and they're really pushing ahead with it all. I don't think that it's necessarily inevitable that this kind of thing happens, or maybe it's inevitable, but it didn't have to be Apple. But Apple's really, they see where entertainment is going, I think, and they're going in that direction along with it, which I think is a really great thing. Same reason as it is so great that the Nanos play video. You know, it's about artists being able to deliver their stuff online without the interference or the insurmountable obstacle of, you know, national competition. That you just can't even compete with in any way. I mean, it's still hard to compete with a multi-million-dollar campaign, ad campaign, but at least you've got some really cool devices that you can show people your work on and maybe share it with them and stuff like that. That's really cool. I think it's going to make a big difference for a lot of independent artists, and I like the independent artists. I think they're doing all the work these days. You know, Hollywood and the big record labels, to me, have got nothing going on, but that's just my own artistic opinion. So the iPhone has been obviously the subject of much hacking and cracking and programming. Everyone's trying to get into it and modify it and do interesting things on it. And, you know, it's kind of becoming clear, I think, as to why Apple is not opening the iPhone up yet. You know, no matter how much they hyped it, no matter how much people are in love with it right now, including myself, it's a new product. It's the first product of its kind, and to just let that loose on third-party application developers is kind of a dangerous thing, because if you do that, then you've got a whole bunch of unpredictable applications living on this device that people are then going to come in to your Apple stores and say, hey, why isn't this thing working? And if you look at the Apple stores, you can see that they're really doing a great job at managing iPhone problems and iPhone issues, and they're really taking note of, you know, causes of different problems and what's occurring, and, you know, they're really, it's obvious that they're doing a lot of troubleshooting and a lot of testing so that the next revision can overcome all of that stuff. Whatever those issues might be. Honestly, I haven't had a problem with my iPhone yet, but whatever issues have been coming up, they're doing a great job of taking note of it and making sure that it gets worked around later on. You know, they're supporting what they can trace back, what they can troubleshoot. And if they all came from Apple, Even if it is just a stocks widget and a weather widget, at least they know exactly where that code came from. At least they can look back at it and say, you know what, right here, that's got to be the problem. Whereas if it's a third-party application, it just adds a whole new variable in there. And I can understand that. It's probably, you know, eventually they're going to have to unlock it and let third parties get in on the action. But right now, for quality control, I can see why a software developer kit hasn't been released. I can see why it's not just an open platform for anyone to do anything on it. Because it's amazing what people will do to their devices. You know, I see people with their computers with all kinds of crazy things on it. And you're just like, well, this is all very interesting, but you're now asking me why, you know, why Photoshop is crashing. Who could begin to guess why Photoshop is crashing with all of the random crazy stuff that they have on their computers? Or whatever. I mean, maybe not Photoshop, whatever. Lots of weird little minor hacks. I mean, you kind of have to, you're to make it look cool and act cool and do things cool, you have to understand that that's no longer what would be called a production machine. It's not a production-ready machine. It's something that's not a controlled environment, something that would be very difficult to troubleshoot. You have to keep that in mind. So if you've got a computer that you rely on and that you need for work, stay away from the cool mods. You know, get someone's secondhand iBook and mod that, or get an iMac from someone, one of the old iMacs. People throw those out all the time. Grab it before it hits the trash, take it home, mod it like crazy. But your work machine, that's your work machine, that's your production machine. Keep it clean, keep it something that you can troubleshoot. You know, stay away from the cracked software. It's not an ethical thing, it's a troubleshooting thing. You know, you can't keep playing with code like that. It's going to start screwing you up, possibly. And if it's a production essential machine, you need to keep it really clean. Okay, so I got some listener email, which is much appreciated, by the way. You can definitely feel free to email us at any time with questions or comments. It's Gort, G-O-R-T, dot Klaatu, K-L-A-A-T-U, at gmail.com. It's appreciated because, you know, it's great to know people are listening, and I love to answer questions. So this first one is from Beth. And after she gives us many, many compliments on the show, well, maybe one or two. Well, Beth, that's a good question. And yeah, it's entirely possible to do that. It's not necessarily the safest and most secure. I mean, it's safe, but it's not the most secure thing. I mean, if your idea is to truly conceal information so that it cannot be retrieved, this isn't the way to do it. The better way to do that would be maybe a file vault or something like that, which is very secure, but it's also a little bit dangerous because if you forget your password, it's gone. So I'm going to answer your question as is, assuming that all you really want to do is hide the files from either prying eyes or, I guess, if someone who doesn't know what they're doing steals your laptop, this might be the way to go. Again, I mean, if you're, you know, if someone steals your laptop and they actually know a little bit something about Unix systems, then I don't know, they could feasibly find this because it's really just a simple, very, very simple Unix trick. And it's not really for security. That's not what they do, the invisible folders. It's more just so that things that you don't really need to look at every day kind of stay out of your way. The only way I know to do it is in the terminal. So if you open up your terminal, you can just make sure where you are. You should be in your home folder. So if you just type in pwd, that's pwd, it'll show you where you are, and it should read /users/beth, or whatever your user folder is called on your computer. So if you're there, you simply type in mkdir, that's make directory, mkdir, space, dot, hidden, or whatever you want to call the folder. Basically, what you're doing, anything after a dot, if dot is the first letter of a file name in Unix, it is hidden. It just doesn't show up. And you can confirm this by going over to your Finder and look at your little house. That's your user folder. And you'll see the same folders as you always see there. And there won't be any folder called hidden there. Alright, well now if you go back to the terminal for a minute, type in ls space dash al. Now you get a list of everything that's really in your user folder. And the first thing you'll see is a dot, and then you'll see two dots, and then you'll see a couple of other things, maybe a dot trash, maybe a dot os underscore store, but eventually you'll see a dot hidden, because that's what we just called the folder. Now you don't, the word hidden I just used because that's what you're doing, you're hiding the folder. You can call it anything. You could call it, well, whatever, dot Beth, dot folder, dot whatever. Call it dot bad apples. Maybe people wouldn't look in there. And then you'll see the other folders. So the hidden ones are the ones with dots in front of them. So how to get into that folder, that's the trick, actually. So there's a way to do it in the terminal. You just change cd, that's change directory, cd space dot hidden, and then you're in that folder. But that might not do you a whole lot of good if you're not used to using the terminal and you don't want to go copying your financial files into that folder that way. So if you need to do it in the GUI, in the graphic portion of OS 10, then you go back to your Finder, go to your Go menu. Believe it or not, there's a Go menu at the top of your Finder. I know you've probably never used it. And there is a selection right down at the bottom, second one down from the bottom, and it says Go To Folder. So now if you type in Go To Folder, you can actually define where you want it to go to. And you have to do the whole path. So it's slash users with a capital U, slash whatever your username is. So let's just say Beth. So it's slash users slash Beth. And remember that this is all case sensitive. So if you've named something with a capital letter, you have to use a capital letter here. It's very particular about that. So in my case, it's slash capital U users slash capital or lowercase everything slash clatu slash dot hidden. And voila, it opens that folder up in the Finder window. And you can drag whatever you want in that Finder, in that folder, and no one will really be able to see those documents. Now again, the weird thing about this is that you have to kind of keep in mind, I mean, it's not super secure. You figure if look, go back to the Go menu and go back to the Go To folder. See, it keeps the last place that you went to. So it wouldn't do you much good if someone came up right now and stole your laptop, because they could just, if they knew enough, they could go to that folder, and there's the location of your hidden folder, and there it is. Now, whether anyone would know to do that, I mean, that's highly unlikely, but you never know, you know? I mean, I'm just pointing out that it's not super secure. You can also access those files potentially, depending on what kind of files they are. You know, if it's a file that a program says open recent, and it keeps track of what you've had open in the past, like, couple of days, then they could feasibly say open recent, they could see, you know, my bank records, and they could open that just straight from the application. So it's kind of iffy. I mean, it's better than leaving it out in the open, I guess, but I don't know if I would say that was the most secure way of doing things myself. One thing that you can do that might be a little bit better is make that a little bit more roped off from other users. So if your laptop gets stolen and it's not logged in to your user account, so to get to all your information in the first place, that person would have to crack your password to even log in. So hopefully you have your login screen enabled. If you don't, you really should. Even if you're the only person in the house or in the apartment, you can't imagine why anyone would ever use your computer. You hate to log in, it's a bother. Well, if you're worried about safety and security, you want to make people log in, because that way anyone who gains access to your computer, if you don't have them logging in first, they just turn it on and they have access to everything you own on that computer. If you force it to go to a login screen first, it's a lot harder. So the first thing that you want to do is go to your System Preferences, which is in your Apple menu. Go to System Preferences. Down at the bottom, there should be an Accounts button. Hit Accounts. Now this might be locked, so if it is locked, it's locked on mine. really ought to be locked on yours, but unlock it. And to do that, just press that little lock on the bottom left of the window. It'll prompt you for your password, type in your password, and then it'll unlock itself. So the first thing that you want to do is click Login Options, which is just above the lock. And the first selection in this window is Automatically Login As. So if that's checked on, check that off. And that way it will bring you to a login window when you first turn on your computer. And you can have that as helpful or as obscure as you want. You can either display the login window as a list of the users that you can sign in as, or you can actually require both the name and the password. That's two things that someone who's gained access to your computer has to guess. They have to guess your username, which could be anything, and they have to guess your password, which hopefully could be anything. And you can use that as a sort of a first roadblock to even getting into your computer at all. So then lock that window back up just so that it's locked. It shouldn't go unlocked. No reason to have it unlocked. And then the other thing that you can do to kind of protect that hidden folder is to actually change permissions for that hidden folder. File permissions is a really big deal in Unix systems, and it's fairly esoteric. I mean, it's not the easiest thing in the world to understand necessarily, but it's kind of important to understand as well. The way that it's done in your Finder is with the Apple I. So if you go to your Finder and you select, I don't know, let's select something fairly, you know what, take a screenshot. That's Apple Shift 3. That'll take a screenshot. That's something totally pointless. We don't need to worry about it. So there's, on your desktop, there should be a new picture. It should be called, like, picture one or whatever. Depends on how many pictures you've got on your desktop. If you do a lot of screenshots, you're probably already familiar with this process. Otherwise, it'll just be a little document, and it'll say picture one. Click on that once and hit Apple I. And that brings up all the information about this picture. The file size, 136 kilobytes, pretty small. The kind of file it is, when it was created, and even more importantly, kind of way down there, there's very bottom, there's something called ownership and permissions. Now, if you click on the little triangle next to that, it shows you exactly who gets to do what with this file. And if you click on the details, it tells you exactly what kind of access they have. So without going too deep into this, because I know you didn't really ask about this, Beth, the top drop-down menu is what you can do, you as your own user, what you're allowed to do. Now, if you give yourself read and write permission, that's a really good idea. Obviously, you want to have full control over that file. The owner should be you. The group, depending on what group we're talking about, if you're aware that you have groups on your computer, then you can give that group whatever permission you feel they should have. If you don't have any groups, you should probably go ahead and put that as no access, because there's no reason for anyone else but you to have access to that file. Follow me? And then the very bottom menu is Others, and that right now says Read Only. Well, again, there's no reason for any other person but you to have access to this file. So click on that drop-down menu and say No Access. Now, that file has been locked off to anyone but you. And that's a really good thing. Now, again, that's not going to help you a bit if your computer is logged in as your user and someone comes up and takes it and walks away with it. Then they are basically, as long as they don't turn it off or ever log out or ever restart, they're you, as far as the computer knows. But at least if they do walk away with it and they are not able to log in as you, but they're able to log in maybe as someone else, or they're able to get on through some other method, they still couldn't get access to that without knowing your password and your name. So that's a really strong and good idea to do. Now, to do that to a hidden folder, it's a little bit more complex, because obviously we don't have an icon for a hidden folder. We can't invoke a get info for that. So you have to do that in the terminal. And the way to do it in the terminal is fairly easy. It's with the chmod command. So if you go to your terminal and type chmod, well, first of all, make sure that you are in your home directory. So again, pwd should reflect /users/beth or whatever your username is. Now we can decide to modify the permissions of that hidden folder. So what we'll do is say chmod, that's chmod, u, that's the letter u, equals rwx space dot hidden, or whatever you called your hidden folder. Okay, so now if you do an ls space dash al, you'll see the list of your folders again. And if you look down at your .hidden, you'll see that the first couple of letters will be D. That's saying that it's a directory, which we call folders in Mac. It's a directory, and RWX, that's U right there. And then some other letters after that. Well, what we want to do is get rid of all those letters. So to do that, you type in chmod OG, that's OG, equals space dot hidden. So now what that is doing is setting the group and others to no access. And so now if you do an ls-al, you will see the dot hidden folder, you will see drwx, and a series of dashes after that, meaning that if someone is able to get into your system with a username other than your own and without your password, they will not be able to access that folder. Okay, the next email, get that up on my screen, is from Manuel, Manuel. And Manuel asks, I go to a lot of hacker sites, I don't know what that is, but okay, hacker sites, and their screenshots always look really cool with a lot of code over their screens. Is this something they are doing in Photoshop, or is this what their computers look like? And if so, does your computer look like this? And how can I make mine look like this? Okay, so I know what you're talking about, actually, Manuel. So, yeah, you're talking about the people who customize their desktops a lot, which actually is a question that I got from someone else as well. Well, it's pretty similar. I think you're very specifically talking, though, about the code that you'll see sometimes kind of floating over everything else. That's not just code floating. That's their terminals, usually. That's their terminal or their console or their xterm. It kind of depends on, you know, what OS they're running. A lot of these sites are showing screenshots of really crazy-looking Linux desktops, which a lot of times look completely unlike anything you've ever seen. But at the same time, the Mac desktop can look pretty wacky as well. The first stop that you're probably going to want to make just to really customize it and make it look really cool is unsanity.com, which I mentioned in episode, whatever. I don't remember the number, but it's about customizing your Mac desktop, whole episode on it. If you haven't heard it yet, you should go listen to that, because that'll give you the different themes, and it'll just look totally unnatural and very cool. But the thing that I think you're really asking about is ways to actually customize the terminal in such a way that you literally do have line commands kind of like on top of everything else. But understand that that's not just floatings, and that's above everything. So if you're not using the terminal, you kind of have to get that out of the way. They do that just for the screenshot. They don't necessarily always use it that way. But let's assume that we're talking about cool terminal tricks. So, and this is really easy, and it actually has not a whole lot to do with the terminal itself. It's terminal settings. Because the terminal, a true terminal is basically a black screen with text on it. I mean, that's a terminal. The terminal that we use is kind of an emulator. It's emulating a shell, which is the black screen with like text on it. So what we use is very software dependent. So the default OS X terminal comes up, as you probably have seen, as a white window with black text. Very not cool, you know? It's like very, it looks basically like text edit or something like that, only without all the options. But you can make it look totally cool. So, what you can do is open the terminal application, first of all, and go up to Terminal. That's the menu, Terminal. And it's just to the right of the Apple window. And select Window Settings. From here, to be honest, it's self-explanatory, but just in case, there's a drop-down menu in the Window Setting window. You can select Color. And in this pane, you can set the background color. Even more importantly, you can set the transparency. So if you do like a black background, and then obviously either white or green or something, or blue text, that's good. But then you can make the background like transparent. So you can make it like 50% transparent, and suddenly it seems, yeah, like it's kind of, you know, a shade over your desktop. Or you could even make it completely transparent and just have floating text. That's kind of weird. I don't think I would do that myself, but certainly if you want to, you can, if it fits in with your theme. And it's actually kind of helpful, to be honest, to have it that, like, I have mine usually at 80% opacity, because then you can kind of see some of the files that you might be referencing or using in the background, and especially if you're learning the terminal, that's a great way to kind of see it, because then you're like, you know, you kind of get your bearings if you can see the background, like a certain folder, and then you see it also in your terminal, and you're like, ah, I see how those two things relate now. Yeah, I usually have mine like black screen with like green text, or depending on my theme, I'll have like blue text. Another useful setting here in the window setting is the emulation selection. And you can turn off those really annoying audible alarms. I can't stand those bells that if you mistype it, like, it rings. You're going to want that off. That's something that, I don't know why the Mac terminal does that, but it's just, it kills me every time I do it. You can turn that off. You can have a visual alarm, which it'll, like, flash your, terminal screen, like, flashes. But even that, to be honest, I kind of find annoying, and I don't really find that I need it. And then in the display selection of that same drop-down menu, you can change the cursor style, so you can have it like as a solid block cursor, or you can have it as an underscore or a vertical pipe, whatever. You can customize the font, and make sure that you're not doing any weird font, because sometimes, you know, if you're typing things, I mean, obviously the terminal is very text-dependent, so you want something that's very readable and legible to you. You don't want to be mistaking the number one for like a lowercase l or something like that, because that'll just kind of hang you up. And there you go, man. That's how to make your terminal look cool, like the people on those hacker sites that you're talking about. And he says, P.S., how come you guys don't have screenshots of your computers? And that's a fair question, and I should have a screenshot of my computer up somewhere. But, well, number one, so many of my computers are always going under so many changes. And then number two, there's always something on the desktop making it ugly. You know, there's some project that I'm working on trying to finish up, or something that I need as a reference, and I don't know. Yeah, I should spend an afternoon and make my desktop look pretty and post it on the Bad Apple site and pretend like that's how it always looks and make myself look really cool. And this segues really perfectly into the next question from Jack, and he wants to know how people modify their desktops with the different icons and where to find good wallpapers. And I found this email a little bit interesting, coming to me asking for good wallpapers. I don't know, if you're not aware, there are cool wallpapers on the Bad Apple site, and you're probably not asking me you know, about that, but I wasn't sure if you knew, because not everyone does know. If you're getting this podcast through iTunes, you might not have actually visited the site. So if you want to go to thebadapples.info, or I think it's thebadapples.5gbfree.com. That's thebadapples.5gbfree.com. That will take you to the site where all the old episodes are listed there for you to listen to if you want to. And you can also get a whole bunch of really cool wallpapers that we work on here at the Bad Apples Underground hideout. And we post them online. And, you know, some of them aren't bad. They're not half bad. So you can do that. The only place, to be honest, that I ever go to wallpapers for are either kde-look.org or gnome-look.org. Both of those sites, they're not really Mac-driven, but they just have really cool artwork anyway. So kde-look.org and gnome, that's G-N-O-M-E, -look.org. And yeah, I'm saying GNOME correctly, so. Now the other cool thing about customizing desktops, Jack, is that there are really great icons out there, and I could list off probably a million good icon sites, and they're kind of always changing here and there, so it's kind of hard to pin one down, but one that I've gone to a lot is PixelGirlPresents, .com. Another one is, I think it's panicfactory.com. But one great place to get started is to just go to, well, there's a great program called iCandy. And it's not free, but it's well worth the money if you're interested in customizing your icons. It makes it really, really easy to do it. You just, let me Google their site because I literally cannot remember, where they're from. Okay, it's not iCandy, it's Candy Bar. Sorry, whatever. So it's panic.com/candybar, and it will help you customize your OS X icons. It's, I think, probably like $20, and it makes it just really simple, and every icon that you see on your computer, you can change. Even better, people all over the place are making icons for this, and some of them are even making what they're calling I containers, and the I containers are basically just a full-on change of every icon. You know, it's just like 100 or more icons that'll just change every icon on your system with basically one drag and drop. So if you find one theme that you like, you can just drag it onto your candy bar, and bang, it changes all your icons. So that's really, really neat. And yeah, I mean, once you get in this far to icons, you'll find nice sites with you know, lots of OS X icons. One, interfacelift.org, I think that's a good one. That's Interfacelift. And they're not necessarily exclusively Mac OS X, but they have a whole OS X department. They've got icons, wallpapers, themes, things like that. So that's another good place, I guess, for wallpapers. I've gotten some good wallpapers from them, actually. I forgot about them until just now. I should actually go back and check them out again. A really cool thing, and I always try to remind people that, you know, if you've got the time and the inclination and the skill at all, you can actually create your own, you know, fonts, wallpapers, and icons. And that's a really great way to mod your system, too. The easiest way to make your own icons is Iconographer. And you can find that at imscape.com. That's just the letter M, scape, S-C-A-P-E, that's all one word, .com. And Iconographer is a great little application that lets you bring in, you know, pictures that you make, and you can make them into icons. And you can even make it so that, for instance, if you have maybe a whole computer, you know, maybe you've drawn a computer, and that's your icon. But then at a certain point, you know how you can make your icons shrink, right? You can make them really, really large, like 128 pixels by 128 pixels, or you can make them really, really tiny, like 16 by 16. So what you can do with Iconographer is actually make it so that as you shrink your icons at a certain point, like maybe once they hit like the 32 pixel by 32 pixel level, it actually changes into something simpler and smaller. So that's really handy so that you're not using like a big icon, and then when it gets down to really something really small, maybe in a menu or something like that, you can't even tell what it is. So that's a really cool feature, and it's a really great little application. I keep thinking it's free, and I'm pretty sure it is. I mean, I got mine quite a while ago, and I keep thinking it was free. But check it out. It's a great application. And if you have that kind of time and that kind of skill, by all means, make icons and post them to sites, because that's a great way to mod your system and to help other people mod theirs. Another place you can find icons a lot of times is actually just the apple.com/downloads site. They have icons themes that will typically take you to other sites, and you'll find a whole host of new icons there. So, that's, I think, all I got for you, Jack. One more question, and then I'm out. So, Terry says, how can I get quicker at doing things on my Mac? Every time I go into an Apple store, the salespeople show me something, and it seems like they do in 10 seconds what usually takes me a minute. How do they learn all those tricks? Great question, Terry. I feel for you. I know what you're talking about. We've all been there. Especially if you're new to a Mac, or if you're new to OS X, or if you're just kind of new to computing, you might be thinking, how do I learn all those keyboard shortcuts? And, keyboard shortcuts, to a degree, have always been around, but they haven't necessarily been, I think, as prominent as they are now. I think with a lot of the pro applications like Photoshop and Avid and Final Cut, when those start coming about, where it really did become very functional for them to have lots of keyboard commands so that people could just kind of trigger things that they were using frequently, I think that started to maybe bleed over into the operating system. At least that's my impression. I could be wrong. I haven't done any extensive research on the origin of them, but that's kind of my impression of the state of things. So nowadays, keyboard shortcuts are just ridiculously prominent. And the first stop that you should make is your system preferences. It's in your Apple menu. Go down to your system preferences, go to your keyboard and your mouse, and go over to the little tab there that's labeled, of all things, keyboard shortcuts. And there, in an albeit not super user-friendly way, is a list of pretty much all the keyboard shortcuts you could ever want to know about. There's screenshots, there's universal access, there's keyboard navigation, there's the dock, expose, dictionary, spotlight, applications, things like that. Is that all of them? No, that's not even close to all of them. There's just an amazing amount of weird sort of keyboard tricks that you can do on a Mac that, frankly, I don't really know how you learn them. You just kind of learn them by doing. One way to find out a lot of them is when you're doing things by menus, take the extra moment that it takes to look at the right side of the menu and take a look at those little keyboard commands so that it tells you what these things are. For instance, in the edit menu, something that we use all the time, there's cut, copy, paste, and select all. If you don't know that cut is Apple X or Command X, then take a look next time you go to cut something or copy something. Take a look and see what that keyboard shortcut is. The way you learn is to take a couple of moments here and there to slow yourself down, look at what you're doing, take note of it, and then the next time you do it, try to remember back and say, yeah, last time I copied, I did a Apple C, and then I pasted with an Apple V. So there's a lot of different things that you can do to make yourself kind of get into good habits. And obviously practice is the best way. And you'd be amazed at how far you can get within certain places entirely keyboard driven. So if you're in your Finder, for instance, and you have nothing open, hit Apple N. That brings up a Finder window. Hit Apple Shift A. That brings you to your applications folder. Really, Apple Shift A, try it. Now type in text. T-E-X. That takes you right to text edit. Now hit Apple O. That opens up text edit and gives you a blank document. And now you can start typing. So you've done all that without even one mouse click. Let's see, what else can you do? Apple N, go into your pictures. So hit P, and that takes you to your pictures folder. Apple O to open that. Go into a folder in there by just hitting the first couple of letters of that folder, and it'll take you right to the folder. Open that, Apple O. find a picture that you want. One great way to navigate through a folder is to simply hit like A or something to get yourself into that into the list, and then you can arrow around right in that folder. So if I go to my utilities folder, for example, Apple Shift U takes me to right to my utilities. If I hit A, it takes me to my first icon, which is Activity Monitor. Well, maybe I didn't want that. Maybe I want to kind of see what I've got. So I can arrow down, go to Disk Utility, or I could arrow down and go to X11. You know, anything I want, really. So yeah, practice exercises like that. That's really helpful stuff. Apple Delete moves something to the trash. And everything has the key to what the keyboard shortcut is right there in the menu where you have to go anyway if you don't know what you're doing. So don't ignore those little hints that they're giving you off in the menu commands. If you go to your file in your Finder, go to File, you see right there, new Finder window is Apple In. Hey, how could you not have known that? A new folder, to create a new folder rather than going to the File menu and making a new folder, it's Apple Shift In. So that's a good note. The up arrow in the menu where it has that big fat up arrow, that's the shift key. Okay, hard to remember maybe, but if you think about it, it's actually pretty easy. A shift does what? Well, it brings something up. It makes an uppercase letter. So shift is the up arrow. The little squiggly cloverleaf thing is your Apple key or your command key. The weird looking thing right next to new smart folder, it looks like kind of a slash with a dot by it or something, that's the option key. And the way I remember that is because, well, it is a slash. And if you think about when you're considering your options, a lot of time you think, well, I can have this, slash, or that. You know, a slash. So that's how I remember it. You can think of another way to remember it if you want, but that's how I remembered it from the start, so that kind of helps. The less intuitive, even less intuitive maybe, is control. And I'm trying to find something with a control as a modifier. There aren't that many control modifier keys, modifier commands in OS X. That's something more common in Linux. Can't really find one, but the sometimes you might see it, and that's just a caret. You know, the caret right above the 6 number key? That means control. But that's a little bit rare. I don't really... I mean, I know that... Final Cut uses the control key a lot, so you'll see it if you're a Final Cut user, but you don't really see it so much in other applications that I can think of. But yeah, pay attention to those menus and get to know them and take time to practice. And also when you're doing things, those everyday tasks that you've just kind of gotten into a habit of going into a certain menu and bringing up a certain application and doing a certain thing, well, why not try to stump yourself one day? And instead of doing it in your normal way. It might take you longer at first, but try to do it, you know, practically entirely keyboard driven. Or try to find shortcuts to do things. When you're in one application, for instance, and you need to see something behind it, try hitting Apple H. That'll hide the application. It's a great little shortcut. It doesn't close the application, it doesn't send it to the dock, it just hides it really quickly and promptly. To get it back, just click on its icon in the dock. Or hit Apple Tab, and you can switch through all your different applications. There's some really great tricks. All it takes is a little bit of time to force yourself to practice them and to pay attention to where you can find those keyboard shortcuts out, which is right there in the menus. That's all the emails I've got. Thank you so much for all the emails. That was fantastic. I love these questions. They're cool. They let me know what you guys need to hear about, and they make me think.
You know, if I could just make a decent cup of coffee, I could relax.
I think it's time for a terminal line command, although it seems like we've been in the terminal a lot, but hey, let's do something really cool. Let's do a terminal command. Okay. Have you ever tried to send something to someone, and maybe if they're using Hotmail or some other cheap email program, maybe they've got like some kind of crazy limit size limitation. They can't receive anything over 3 megabytes. Or maybe you're a video editor and you have huge files that you just need to get onto some kind of portable media, and instead of going out and buying a hard drive, you need to get it onto a disk of some sort. But it's a huge file, it won't fit onto a normal DVD. Maybe you want to email yourself something or post something online for yourself, but it's just too huge to do as one huge file. Who knows what the cause is, but there are certain times that huge files need to be cut down to size. And I'm not talking about zipping, and I'm not talking about compressing or stuffing or tarring, g-zipping, or anything like that. I'm gonna talk about splicing. It's a simple command line program. It's called split. And I think the easiest way to show it to you is to do it. So it's a really cool way of basically slicing up the data in the file that you're talking about, that you're trying to get onto some, a CD or a DVD or whatever. You take it to the location that you need it to be in, and then, amazingly, you can reassemble them without any kind of harm done to them whatsoever. Seems too good to be true, right? Not so. Let's open up the terminal. And I guess the first thing we should do is take a screenshot. Those are just really easy ways for us to get something that we can all use together. So Apple Shift 3 takes a screenshot and places it on your desktop. So if you did what I was doing earlier, you already have a picture 1, so this will be picture 2. And granted, this is a tiny file, so splitting this picture is, probably not something you would really do. I mean, it's a tiny little picture, but let's just assume. Alright, so first thing we're going to type in our terminal is cd, that's change directory, desktop, with a capital D. And that'll take you to your desktop. And if you type in ls, you should see that little picture that we already took. Now, if you type in ls space dash l, that's going to show you more information about that file. So it's a picture, and it's got, on the far left, it's got the user permissions, which we were actually talking about with Beth's hidden file. We were talking about user permissions. It shows you who the owner is, Klaatu, and then it shows you in bytes how large that picture is. So bytes may or may not be very useful to you, but if you just remember that it's 3 decimals over for a kilobyte, so it's this, the one that I just took is 87,046 bytes, so that turns into, 88 kilobytes, right? So it is really, really small, absurdly small. But we're going to split it up anyway. The way it's done is that you type in split, that's S-P-L-I-T, all lowercase, space, dash B, and then you're going to do however many kilobytes per file you want it to be. So let's just say 25K. So it's dash B space 25, that's 25K. And then you're going to type in picture backslash space 1.png, or whatever format you have your system set to take screenshots in. Remember that backslash because Unix doesn't like spaces, so if you have a space in the file name, which picture 1 or picture 2 will have a space in it, you'll need to do that. So then hit return, and now do an ls-l on your in your desktop, and you will see that 4 new files have been created very cryptically. Mine are named xaa, xab, xac, xad. Pretty crazy, right? Well, those are the pieces of your file, and you can see from the file size displayed in the 5th column over that they are, the first 3 are 25, almost 26 kilobytes, and the last one is about 10 kilobytes to round it out. So those are the files that we've split it into, and assuming that we were talking perhaps about megabytes or gigabytes here, well, number one, it would have taken a lot longer to complete that task, but number two, we would have as many files as it needs to take in the file size that we specify to make up you know, the data that we are trying to represent, to split up, I guess. So these pieces you could burn to like a CD each or a DVD each. It's also, I guess, kind of a cool way to thwart, you know, would-be information people. You know, I mean, security, you know, if you're trying to make it harder for people to read your stuff, you could split it up, I guess. It's not super secure. I mean, anyone who knows enough about this kind of stuff could probably figure it out, you know, as to what it is. But, so you send it to wherever you want to send it, and then when you get it to that location, you need to obviously reassemble it. And I guess it's also doesn't probably need to be said that you wouldn't want to do this and send it to someone who maybe, you know, has no idea what the terminal is and has no idea. I mean, you don't want to send it to someone and then say, "Dear Frank, just open this up in your terminal, and to splice it back together, you can do such and such." I mean, that's probably not a good idea. But I'm going to assume you would have known that and pretend like I didn't even have to tell you. The reassembly really is pretty easy if you know what you're doing. So if you've now had all of these files put onto your other computer or wherever you've taken them, you open up your terminal, and you would say, okay, it would probably be easiest to just copy all of these bits and pieces to the computer that you're going to have it on. Maybe just put it out on the desktop for ease of use, you know. So you'd go to your terminal, you'd go to your desktop, which would just be CD desktop, and then you would type in CAT, 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 and then XAA, XAB, XAC, XAD. So basically you're just listing all of the files that you know that you want to sew back together with a space in between each. So what we've got is CAT space XAA space XAB space XAC space XAD. And then you want to type in shift period, which gives you the greater than or the less than sign, whatever sign that is. Seems like someone should make a better name for that symbol. Anyway, so it's shift period, and then space again, and then whatever you want to call the file once you sew it back together. Let's call it concatenated.png, or whatever you want to call it. You can call it anything. Hit return, and now you've got another file on your desktop called concatenated.png. And amazingly enough, if you go ahead and double-click on that concatenated.png, you'll see the file that you, the screenshot that you took moments ago, completely reassembled as if though it never was split. And understand that the rest of the stuff you can ditch. You can get rid of your original screenshot. You can get rid of the XAA, XAB, XAC, XAD, all that other stuff. And you've got just one concatenated.png that you're able to open up just as normal. And that'll work with any file format. It doesn't really matter what file format it is. The data's there, you're just splitting it up into separate portions so that you can reassemble it later. This has been The Bad Apples. If you would like to email us, please do so at gort.klaatu@gmail.com. That's gort.klaatu, KLAATU, @gmail.com. If you'd like to go to the website for either past episodes or your free desktop art, you can find us at thebadapples.5gigabytesfree.com. That is thebadapples.5gbfree.com. You can also direct your browser to thebadapples.info. Music was provided by Fat Chance Lester. Everything was mixed in free and open source software. Tune in next time for more Mac apps, Mac hacks, and Mac tips.
There are no Z-rays.